All right, you notice that today we're not doing any laboratory exercise, which means you just need to listen to me today. We're going to talk about DNA more than we already have, because so much of modern biotechnology relates to DNA in some way. You know, it's manipulating DNA in some way, usually, is what the modern way of conducting biotechnology amounts to. And we know a lot about DNA nowadays. There's still many questions that need to be answered, but we know this molecule pretty well. And DNA is a household word now. You know, you don't have to be a biologist to have heard of DNA. It's in the news all the time. But it's only fairly recently that we've figured this out in the history of wondering about organisms. So it's only in the last 80 years or so that all this has become, not all of it. What we know has become clear. And there were some important experiments in the history of figuring out DNA that I want to talk about a little bit. This first slide shows you a picture that looks like three aliens, or three cartoons of what we say aliens look like. These are actually, though, real things. This is an actual photomicrograph. These are viruses, or viri. And a virus, remember, is not an organism. Why is it not an organism? Right, it doesn't have at least one cell, so it's not an organism. It's really just a collection of molecules. And there's two major kinds of molecules that a virus is made up of. If we think back to the types of macromolecules that all organisms are made out of, what are those four types? Lipids, proteins, polysaccharides, and nucleic acids, exactly. Those are the four biological macromolecules. And we knew that those were the four kinds of macromolecules already, before we knew what DNA did or whether DNA was the genetic material. We knew that there was genetic material even before we knew what the genetic material was. Gregor Mendel, figured out a lot about genetics before ever knowing what a gene was or what DNA is. But even before we knew that DNA was the genetic material, we knew that DNA existed, just chemically. So for chemical reasons, we knew that cells of any type are made out of those four kinds of macromolecules. And proteins and polysaccharides, we understood. Proteins, polysaccharides, and lipids, actually, all three of them, we understood at least some of their functions. We knew what the kinds of things they did in the cell. And when the question arose as to what actually is the genetic material, then we basically narrowed it down. Well, first of all, we said, well, it's not likely to be just a simple molecule. It's probably a macromolecule. You know, it's unlikely to be a water molecule, for instance, that is holding the information required to be genetic. But we also, when we looked at the list of macromolecules, biologists kind of took out of the running lipids and polysaccharides, for various reasons that I'm not really going to get into. So that left two major possibilities that they were betting on, basically, proteins and nucleic acids. And like I said, we knew that nucleic acids existed because we could detect them chemically. And of course, we knew proteins existed, and we knew at least certain things that proteins did. But those were the only two things that really were in contention as far as being the genetic material. And the main reason that DNA was in the running was because it was there, we could detect it, and we didn't know what it did. So since we didn't notice that it did something else, maybe its job was to be the genetic material. That's the main reason it was included. Proteins were included because most biologists at the time guessed that proteins would have to be the genetic material, not DNA. Most of them thought it would be proteins that ended up being the genetic material. And that's because proteins have almost a limitless degree of complexity. In other words, if you were to design a protein, you could design it to be as complex as you want, to have just about any shape you want. There's so many possibilities when you combine the building blocks of proteins to make the proteins, so many possible combinations, that they figured, well, any molecule that is going to be responsible for carrying this much information for such a complex organism as a human, for instance, that molecule must itself be very complex. So they figured proteins are probably it. But in science, you can't just say it makes sense to say this, therefore we're going to call it a fact. Right? You have to test it. So they said DNA maybe because we don't know what it does otherwise. Proteins probably. Well, this brings us to why we're looking at this virus. A virus is really just a combination of DNA and protein. There are some viruses that use RNA instead of DNA, but most viruses are DNA and protein combination. Okay? In other words, a virus is made out of nothing but exactly the two things that they were trying to narrow down between. Okay? And viruses operate by infecting a cell. Viruses aren't organisms. They don't have the cell to do all the functions that living things do, so they can't reproduce on their own. They have to fool a cell into making copies of the virus. And they do that by infecting the cell. Okay, by injecting the genetic material into the cell, which then makes that cell copy the virus. Okay? This kind of virus, well, I didn't tell you that this is a bacterium, but you can see that by the label that the cell that these things are landing on and infecting is a bacterium. And so a virus that invades a bacterium or attacks it is called a bacteriophage. The phage part of this word means eat. Now, the viruses really don't eat the bacteria. They just use it to make copies of itself. But they do it in such a way that the cell just makes virus after virus until it explodes. So it kills the bacterium. But anyway, a bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that invades a bacterium. Not all viruses invade bacteria. There are viruses that invade our own cells, for instance. Okay, but anyway, in the experiment whose design was to show that one or the other of these two materials that they've narrowed it down to is the genetic material, in this experiment, it made sense to use something that's made out of just those two things. That's what a bacteriophage is, DNA and protein. And so they understood that something is being injected into the cell, the bacterium, in order for these viruses to replicate or reproduce. And whatever that is must be the genetic material. So the experiment really then boils down to figuring out a way to detect whether it's the protein or the nucleic acid that gets injected into the cell. Protein or the DNA. Okay, that's why the people doing this used bacteriophages. Slide 2 shows you their setup. Now they broke this into two parts. So you see the pink flask and the blue flask. This experiment uses a technique called radio labeling. Radio labeling is a way to label materials with radioactivity. Now we're talking about molecules, things that are much too tiny to be able to go in and look at. But you need to be able to keep track of where the protein is going and where the DNA is going, because that's the question, right? Which is being put into the cell is the question. So if you have a way to use radioactive versions of those materials, then even though they're too small to see, you can detect them by detecting their radiation. Okay, the radioactivity produces radiation. That's detectable by instruments. So that will work as long as you can separately label the two different kinds of materials. That's why they had to separate this thing into two batches. In one half of the experiment, they labeled just the protein, and in the other half, they labeled just the DNA. All right? So in the top, the first batch, they used radioactive sulfur, which is just like sulfur. It has the same number of proteins as any sulfur. That's what makes it sulfur. But it has extra neutrons. It's radioactive. It decays and releases radioactivity. Okay? But it's still sulfur. Now, the reason that they chose sulfur is because protein, which is made out of amino acids, remember? There's 20 different amino acids that make up proteins. Not all of those amino acids contain sulfur, but some do. And therefore, when you consider a big protein made up of many amino acids, chances are there's going to be some sulfur in there. Chances are very high that there's going to be some sulfur in there. On the other hand, there's no sulfur at all in DNA. So they knew that for chemical reasons, even though they didn't know what DNA did yet. Therefore, if you grow your bacteria and viruses up in an environment in which the only available sulfur is radioactive sulfur, then when you make these new molecules for these new viruses, the protein is automatically going to be radioactive because it incorporates that radioactive sulfur, right? Because you have to get the atoms from the surroundings. If that's the only available sulfur, that's what's going to be used. And so they did this for a while, grew them up in this radioactive sulfur environment, and that's the pink one. In the second batch, they radio-labeled phosphorus instead. They used radioactive phosphorus. This was another good choice. Even though there are some amino acids that have phosphorus in them, not very many do, for one thing. But every single building block of DNA has phosphorus. So a big DNA molecule is going to be full of phosphorus. And therefore, definitely DNA is going to be radio-labeled if you use radioactive phosphorus. Okay, that's why they chose these two elements. So the blue batch has just the DNA labeled. The pink batch has just the protein labeled. Then they took a sample from these things. And a sample of cells, but cells that were infected. And when a virus infects a bacterium, the virus, which is both molecules, attaches to the surface, but it injects just the genetic material into the cell, leaving the other material behind as a kind of an empty shell. All right? So when they took a sample from this flask, which would include millions of cells and then even more viruses that are attached to them, they then put that into what ended up being the perfect laboratory tool for this, which was just an ordinary bar blender. And the reason that's a perfect tool is because they needed to separate these empty shells of virus left behind from the cells themselves. So the blender stirred it vigorously enough that these empty shells would break off of the surface. But it wasn't too vigorous. It wasn't so so high a stirring rate that it broke the cells apart. You don't want to break the cells open, because if you break the cells open, then they spill the contents out and you have the protein and DNA mixed again, and you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. Okay, you understand what I'm saying there? That's why they used the blender. Then they took the blended material, which has the shells on their own, plus the cells with the genetic material already injected in them, and they put tubes of that into a centrifuge. What does the centrifuge do? Separates them based on weight. The heaviest stuff goes to the bottom, forms a pellet. Well, the heaviest stuff in this mixture by far are the cells. The cells are much heavier than those little empty virus shells. So the precipitate for both batches is the cells. Well, when they did centrifuge the pink stuff, which is what the only stuff that was radioactive in the pink stuff was the proteins, they noticed that the pellet, the heavy stuff, the cells, did not radiate any radiation. Whereas the supernatant, the lighter stuff that floats above it, was radioactive. In other words, the protein was the supernatant in the pink one. That means it was the light stuff. That means it was the shells, the empty shells that were broken off of the cells. Okay? And conversely, on the blue batch, it was the pellet that was radioactive. That when DNA was radiolabeled, they found that radioactivity in the cells, which is where the pellet is. And they didn't find it in the supernatant. So that's pretty dramatic evidence that the genetic material, the stuff that was actually being injected into the cells, was not protein, it was DNA. And so that's a very well-designed experiment, and it both results are very strong. So it kind of definitively demonstrates that DNA and not protein is genetic material. Well, actually, there were, you know, I said that most biologists thought it would have to be protein. So some of them said, okay, yeah, we accept that DNA is the genetic material for this simple virus. But for something as complex as a human, it must still be protein. So they still weren't convinced, even with this experiment. But eventually they came around after a few years. And it's DNA is the genetic material for all organisms, regardless of complexity. All right, let's take a closer look at DNA. It is a nucleic acid. And why is it called a nucleic acid? Right, because that's where you find the stuff, in the nucleus, if you're talking about a eukaryotic cell, of course. A prokaryotic cell has DNA as well. And even though there's no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell, the stuff is still called a nucleic acid. And RNA is called a nucleic acid as well, even though it's not always found in the nucleus. But DNA is found in a eukaryotic cell's nucleus, and it is not only a macromolecule, a large molecule, it's enormous. It is a polymer. It's an example of a polymer. And we've talked about this before, right? Polymers are large molecules that are assembled by linking together monomers, which are the single subunits. What are the monomers that nucleic acids are built out of? Did we already talk about this? Yeah, they're nucleotides, which is you see labeled here with the bracket. Okay, so a nucleic acid, whether it's DNA or RNA, is a polymer made up of nucleotide monomers. And since you string together a bunch of nucleotides, you're forming a strand of nucleotides, of many nucleotides, and therefore you can also call this thing a polynucleotide. So a polynucleotide, that word refers to a single strand of nucleotides, whether it's DNA or RNA. What we're looking at here is just a short segment of the overall length of one DNA polynucleotide. But remember, when we first looked at DNA, when we looked at the four kinds of macromolecules, we said that DNA is a double helix, right? So a complete DNA molecule is not just one polynucleotide. It's two polynucleotides, two strands that are held together and that twist into a helical shape. So we're not looking at a complete DNA molecule here for two reasons. One is that it's not nearly long enough. There are literally millions of nucleotides linked end to end, making up just one DNA molecule. That's one reason we're not seeing nearly the entire length, but we're also only seeing one strand of it. There would be another strand on this as well. Now, back to a building block. A nucleotide is a single subunit, but that single subunit can itself be is made of three parts, three smaller parts. A nucleotide consists of the three parts that are shown in every one of these four nucleotides that are shown here. Okay, this is a nucleotide, it's another one, and one at the top. Each nucleotide has to have these three parts. It has to have a sugar, which is what this blue thing is in each case. And specifically, it's a pentose sugar. The OSE ending means sugar, and pent means five. So there's different kinds of pentose sugars, but pentose simply means a sugar that has five carbon atoms in it. That's why it's called that. And this is the one of the major differences between DNA and RNA. RNA, which stands for ribonucleic acid, uses a sugar called ribose. Notice the OSE ending again. Okay, so if you're making an RNA molecule by building it out of RNA nucleotides, those RNA nucleotides are RNA nucleotides because the sugar they use is ribose. DNA is similar. The sugar that we see right here, because this is DNA, not RNA, this is just like ribose, except it. In ribose, there would be another oxygen right here. And that is the only difference. So this one is called deoxyribose, meaning just like ribose without one oxygen. Deoxy. That's what DNA stands for, deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, and in every nucleotide, if you're building DNA, every one of those nucleotides is going to use the same sugar, deoxyribose, not ribose. Okay? So that's one of the three parts of a nucleotide, the sugar. That sugar is connected to the other two parts, but at different positions. At one position, there is a phosphate group, and that's what these yellow circles are. A phosphate includes phosphorus and oxygen atoms, but the whole collection of them is called a phosphate. The sugar, though, is also connected at a different point to the thing that's hanging off to the right of each of these nucleotides. And these things are called nitrogenous bases because they contain nitrogen. That's what nitrogenous means. Well, notice that if it weren't for these nitrogenous bases, every one of these nucleotides would be identical because the sugar is the same and all phosphates are the same. So the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides is because there are different kinds of nitrogenous bases. There are four nitrogenous bases that are normally used in DNA. And that's why there are exactly four shown here. It just gives you one of each. So those nitrogenous bases are guanine, cytosine, adenine, and thymine, which are abbreviated GCANT. And that is the only reason why DNA is different from organism to organism. You know, if you had only one kind of nucleotide, then a DNA molecule wouldn't be able to really hold information, right? It's just a repetition of building blocks. The reason that DNA is able to hold information, though, is because it can be arranged any way you want it. The specific sequence of nucleotides is the code, right? Just like a combination lock has a code that is a specific sequence of numbers. Here you have a specific sequence of nucleotides, and that's different for different organisms. A lock would be worthless if all you could use is ones, right? Everyone would know everyone's combination. So even though it's shown here as guanine connected to cytosine, I mean right next to cytosine and then adenine and thymine, the order can be anything you want. Every position of the millions in one strand of DNA can be occupied by any one of these four. So if you were to compute the number of possible combinations, it would be 4 raised to the number of nucleotides in that strand. So 4 raised to some number of millions power, which is effectively infinite. It's a ridiculously huge number. It's bigger than there are numbers of atoms in the universe. So it's very good at holding information because it's so long. You know, if you only had 3 nucleotides making up your DNA, then there would only be 4 cubed possibilities, which is 64, right? That's not many possibilities. But every time you add 1, you multiply that number by 4. Were you going to ask a question?
No.
Did someone, or were you just... Oh, okay. I thought I saw someone.
So is that like a mole? Are you saying that it's like a really big number?
A mole is a huge number. 10 to the 23rd.
Yeah.
6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. That, even though that is ridiculously huge, that is effectively 0 compared to 4 to the millionth power. I mean, it is... A mole doesn't even come close. On a scale, you wouldn't even see it. So the DNA number of possibilities, like I say, is effectively infinity. Okay, so another thing we see about this slide, though, is the way that these nucleotides are brought together. The part of this that is shaded in blue is called the sugar phosphate backbone. The sugar phosphate backbone is what holds a strand together along its length. Each nucleotide is connected to the next nucleotide by a bond between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next nucleotide. So this line right here represents a bond, and those bonds are called phosphodiester bonds. But as you go down the length of the strand, it's just sugar, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate all the way down. So it's called the sugar phosphate backbone. Notice that the nitrogenous bases are not involved in that at all. 2 adjacent nitrogenous bases on the same strand are not connected to each other. So they're not holding this strand together at all. They're just hanging off the side. Okay? But the nitrogenous bases are the code, really, because they're the only thing that's different from one nucleotide to the next. All right, now that is just... Oh, another thing before I leave this is that there is a 5 prime end for this overall strand, and there's a 3 prime end. Those numbers come from the numbering of the carbon atoms. Remember I said it's a pentose sugar? Well, here's the first one, second, third, fourth, and fifth carbon. And so this end has a 3 prime end that is not making a bond with anything at the point, because that's the last nucleotide. That one has a 5 prime end that's not making an, that has a phosphate that is not connected to anything else. So there's directionality to each strand. There's a 5 prime end and a 3 prime end. All right? Now when you, I guess I'll say that, what I was going to say when we get to another picture. This woman in slide 4, Rosalind Franklin, is a woman who didn't get due credit while she was alive, but she was really important in the history of figuring out what DNA looks like. So once we knew from the experiments that DNA is the genetic material, the next big question became, well, let's figure out what DNA looks like so that we can figure out how it works. And so the really famous names, if they're not household names, they almost are Watson and Crick. Have you heard of Watson and Crick? Who received the Nobel Prize for figuring out the structure of DNA. Well, their work is really important too. But Rosalind Franklin really helped them out. And she wasn't given credit, I'm sure partly because she was a woman, during a time when very few scientists were women. They weren't really allowed to be, unfortunately. But Rosalind Franklin was a world expert at a technique called X-ray crystallography, or X-ray diffusion, but crystallography is the name of the technique. Crystallography is a general technique in which you figure out the shape of a molecule, which is too small to see, by bombarding it with X-rays. So you shine X-rays onto this molecule, and when the X-rays encounter the molecule, or when they come very close to it, basically, they get bent or diffracted. So when they get diffracted, it depends on the shape of the molecule as to which direction they get bent off to. So you have X-rays, the molecule, and then X-ray film. And depending on which way they get bent, the film is going to have a specific shape. This is a famous photograph done by Rosalind Franklin, because Watson and Crick, who were having trouble figuring out the shape, said, why don't you do this technique to DNA and see what you come up with? This is the famous picture she got out of it, and it doesn't look like much to us, but to an expert in X-ray crystallography, she said, it would make sense if it were a helix. She said, this to me says it must be a helical shape. And so they took her advice and they figured out how to put it together as a helix, and they made their other... They made a tin model, which you might have seen pictures of, that's famous as well, and published their results. Okay, now slide 5 shows you basically how their model looked. This cartoon of the double helix, that's still not a complete DNA molecule because it's not nearly long enough, but it's complete in the sense that it now has both polynucleotide strands. Okay? Each blue ribbon here represents the sugar phosphate backbone of one strand. There are 2 strands here, and notice that the nitrogenous bases, which are the A's, T's, C's, and G's, are just hanging off to the side of each strand. But they interact with each other. Nitrogenous bases on one strand are interacting with nitrogenous bases on the other strand. In the middle here, you see a short segment of the length of a DNA molecule, but it has been untwisted. So it's no longer a double helix. A double helix is kind of like a spiral staircase or a ladder that's twisted. When you untwist it, it looks more like a regular ladder. So there's these the two vertical parts, and then there are many rungs or steps along the ladder. Okay? The sugar phosphate backbones make up the two vertical parts of the ladder. But each ladder step is a pair of nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two strands. And these dotted pink lines represent hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds are very weak forces, but they're attractive forces. And that's what keeps the two strands stuck together. The thing that keeps one strand together along its length is the sugar phosphate backbones made up of the phosphodiester bonds. Okay, those phosphodiester bonds are very strong, so it's hard to break a strand apart along its length. But the two strands that make up one DNA molecule are held together by very weak hydrogen bonds between pairs of nitrogenous bases. And it's important that those are weak, because DNA has two major functions, right? We talked about that. What are those two major functions? Self-replication and storage of codes for how to build proteins, right? Those are the two major jobs. Doesn't matter which of those two jobs you pick, they both require, in order for them to work, they both require separating the two strands from each other, at least in one area at a time. In other words, it requires unzipping this thing. It's like a zipper. You know, when you unzip a zipper, you just separate the two halves. You don't break the one strand of the zipper apart. So these hydrogen bonds are weak enough that you can separate them fairly easily. But since there's millions of them, they add up to being strong enough to keep them together when you do want them to be together. Okay? Now remember I said that there's a 5' end and a 3' end to each strand. A complete DNA molecule is two strands, but the two strands are put together kind of head to tail. Here you have 5' at the top, 3' at the bottom. The other strand is 3' at the top, 5' at the bottom. Okay? So that arrangement is called antiparallel. Okay, now another very important part of the structure of DNA is how these nitrogenous bases come together. When you're making just one polynucleotide, one of the two strands, the order of the nucleotides, the order of the nitrogenous bases, can be anything you want. All right? It can be all A's for a while. Anything. Any position can be occupied by any of the four. But whatever the sequence is on one strand, you're going to have a corresponding sequence on the other hand, not the same sequence, but a sequence that is said to be complementary. It's complementary with an E, not complementary. In other words, DNA has what is called complementary base pairing, or complementarity. That's because an adenine, an A, is normally always paired up with a thymine, or a T, on the other strand. A C always with a G. A G always with a C, and a T always with an A. Alright? And that's really important, otherwise DNA wouldn't work the way it does. Slide 6 describes part of the reason why there is this complementarity. There's two major kinds, even though there's four overall nitrogenous bases that DNA use, you can lump them into two groups. Two of them are called purines, and the other two are called pyrimidines. And that's based on how many rings there are in the structure. When we go back to the other slide, notice that these nitrogenous bases are made out of rings. Well, two of them, guanine and adenine, have two rings in them. The other two, cytosine and thymine, have just one ring in them. The two ringers are called purines. And two rings take up more space than one ring does. The one ringers are called pyrimidines. So if you're building a ladder, meaning a DNA molecule out of two strands, and you allow one purine to bond hydrogen bond with another purine at the same position on the other strand, you're going to make a very long, or very wide, I guess in this case, wide step. Whereas if two pyrimidines join, the step is going to be very narrow. All right? And if you have a pyrimidine and a purine join, it'll be intermediate width. Well, that means your ladder would be zigzagged, right? However, if it's always a purine with a pyrimidine, and it doesn't matter which one's on the left or right, if it's always one of the bigger ones and one of the smaller ones, then you're always going to have the same width of rungs on your ladder. And so that's why it is always a purine with a pyrimidine. That doesn't narrow it down quite as specifically as it happens, though. Slide 7 tells you the rest of the story. Remember, there's two purines and two pyrimidines, so if the only rule were purine with pyrimidine, there would be multiple possibilities. Instead, if it's adenine, which is a purine, it's not just any pyrimidine that is allowed to bind with it, it's always thymine, like I said. Notice you have a double ring here and a single ring here. Well, if it were only purine and pyrimidine is the rule, then this adenine could also bind to the other purine, cytosine. The reason it doesn't, though, is adenine and thymine have two positions for hydrogen bonding, shown by the two pink dotted lines there. Whereas guanine and cytosine both have three positions for hydrogen bonding. So that's the way it happens for chemical reasons. A always with T, C always with G. And because of that, if you were to separate the two strands, if you have a DNA molecule, and let's just pretend it's big enough to look at, you separate the two strands and you completely hide one strand from me, I can tell you exactly what the sequence must be just by looking at the other sequence, right? Wherever I see a G, there has to be a C at that position on the other one. Wherever I see an A, a T, an A, and a G, a C. So by reading one strand, I know what the other strand has to be because of complementarity rules. And that's why DNA is able to replicate itself. If you separate the two strands and you read each one, each strand serves as a template for how to make the other strand. So if you do that for each of them, you end up making two exact copies of the original molecule. That's what's shown in slide 8 here. The parent molecule has a certain sequence. There's a certain sequence on each strand, but the sequence on one strand is complementary to the sequence on the other strand. Always A with T, always C with G. So like I was saying, if you separate the two, you can hide one of them from me, and I can tell you the other one's got to be C, T, A, G, T, based on complementarity rules. And the same way for the other one. So if that's what actually happens in the cell. The two strands are separated. Each strand is red. The code of it is red. And then the light blue stuff here is new material that's laid down according to complementarity rules. The G here says C must be this one, and so on. Same thing's happening with the other, but now when you complete that process, you end up with two double helical models, two complete DNAs that are identical to each other and identical to the original one. That's self-replication. What were you going to ask?
For the letters, are those representing the nitrogens?
Right. Yeah, G stands for guanine, A for adenine, T for thymine, and C for cytosine.
It was always it.
It is possible for, in under rare errors, for other nitrogenous bases to occur, but that's a mutation, basically. So these are the normal four. Yeah.
I was going to ask, is that how, like, the disabilities happen?
That's one way, yes. For genetic disorders, yes. If you have a mutation, in which case you have a different nucleotide in one position compared to normal people, that means you have a different code. Remember, the code is an instruction for how to make a protein. Therefore, you don't make the right protein. The protein doesn't work the way it should, and therefore you have some sort of disorder. That's one nucleotide at a time is being added on when you're when a cell is assembling the DNA.
But does it happen like instantly? Or?
No, it takes some time, but I mean it happens pretty quickly. But you're starting with raw materials. Those raw materials are the individual nucleotides. So you have a pool of all four kinds of nucleotides, but millions of each of the four kinds. And when you're assembling a new DNA molecule, it's not just any of those four that you put on. It's whichever one matches the one that's already there. That's why the original strand operates as a template. Okay, now, how many slides are in this show? Only 12? Okay, then I might as well continue, right? Rather than breaking. Okay. Slide 9 shows you this process of DNA replication. It's a short summary. There's steps I'm skipping here, but for a cell to replicate its DNA, it needs to separate the two strands. And when would a cell do this? When would it copy its own DNA so that it has two copies of DNA?
Right before it splits.
Exactly. When a cell basically is about to end its own lifetime, it's toward the end of what we call the cell cycle, its lifetime is over, because when a cell splits into two, it's not like a woman having a baby. A woman having a baby results in two individuals, but the original mother still exists, right? When a cell splits into two, that original cell is no longer there. You just have two daughter cells, as they're called, even though sex doesn't make any difference there. All right? So that's when DNA needs to be replicated, when a cell is just about to end its own life in order to create two new cells. You need that to happen because each of the two daughter cells needs to have a complete DNA library, just like the parent. If you make two identical copies and then split into two, you are now two cells that are genetically identical to the original cell that no longer exists. This is how we add cells as we grow. Remember, cells can't themselves grow into hugeness because of the surface area to volume ratio. So in order for an organism to get huge, it has to do so by adding a bunch of cells that are still small. DNA replication allows all those cells to have DNA and therefore still have the instructions for how to build the proteins they need to be living cells. That even though occurs in unicellular organisms, like a bacterium. A bacterium never becomes a multicellular organism, but it still undergoes cell division. That's how it reproduces. You know, when a prokaryotic cell, a bacterium for instance, undergoes cell division, it is producing two cells that are now two individuals. And therefore, every time that happens, if all the cells are doing the same thing, which they will be if they're all being fed, then the population doubles every time that a cell splits into two. And that's why you can start on your plates that you streaked with bacteria that are invisible, but each bacterium doubles, and then those double, and then those double. And when you look at it the next day, you see a colony. That colony is millions of cells, and therefore big enough to see. but they all came from that original cell, which is why we call it a colony-forming unit. Okay? So the big difference between prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells, as far as DNA replication is concerned, is how their DNA is shaped. DNA, an entire DNA molecule, is called a chromosome, or I shouldn't say it that way. A chromosome consists of, a single chromosome consists of one huge DNA molecule. A prokaryotic cell, like a bacterium, has just one chromosome, so just one DNA molecule, and it is circular. So the two ends join each other to form a ring. On the other hand, for eukaryotic organisms like ourselves, we have multiple chromosomes, not just one, and the number of chromosomes that we have depends on the species. For humans, for instance, there are 23 different kinds, but you have two of each of those, so each of your cells in your body has 46 chromosomes in that tiny nucleus within that tiny cell. But not only do we have multiple chromosomes, each chromosome is linear, not circular. So a eukaryotic chromosome has two ends to it. And that's the big difference that you see between the top and the bottom here, A and B. All right? Now the replication process has to start somewhere along that chromosome. And the place where it starts has a good name. It's called the origin of replication, which kind of tells you what it does. So the origin of replication is represented on that prokaryotic circular chromosome at the top as those two black dots. The cell recognizes that's where replication should start. And at the origin of replication, the first thing that you have to do in order to be able to read the codes that are in each of the two strands is separate the two strands from each other. Which is easy to do because, like I said, what holds them together are just those weak hydrogen bonds. So the two can be unzipped. And when you separate the two, you make that football-shaped thing at the top, which is called a replication bubble. A replication bubble, since it's football-shaped, has two ends to it, the pointed ends, each of which is called a replication fork. So a replication bubble has two replication forks, one at either end. Replication forks are where the two strands are still together, but that's where they're being unzipped. And as soon as they're separated from each other, then you can read the code in each individual strand and put down new DNA, one nucleotide at a time, according to the complementarity rules. So if you're reading an A, you put down a T. If you're reading a C, you put down a G, and so on. That new material, the new DNA, is represented in this slide, just like the last one, as a light blue line. So you're just filling in the gaps, basically, and you keep unzipping this thing so the replication bubble gets bigger and bigger. Since you're working in this case on a circular chromosome, eventually you'll get to the point where the two replication forks come back together at the other end of the circle. And at that time, you've completed the process. Now you have two completely separate, double-stranded DNA molecules that are identical to each other and identical to the one that you started with. Okay? And therefore, you have enough DNA now to be two cells, so the next thing that happens is the cell splits into two. Each cell has one DNA molecule, one chromosome. The big difference, like I said, for eukaryotic organisms is that their chromosomes are linear. And they also are more complex cells, so they need to make more kinds of proteins, which means they need to have a bigger DNA library. So not only are these things linear, but they're bigger. Well, the bigger the number of nucleotides you have, the longer it's going to take to build a new one, right? So to speed the process up as much as possible, even though it's not as fast as it is for a bacterium, eukaryotes don't just open up one replication bubble per chromosome, which they could. Instead, they open up several replication bubbles simultaneously along the length of one chromosome. If they were to open up just one in the middle and then you unzipped it, you'd have to wait until those forks got all the way to the two ends, right? But if you open it up at several places along that one linear chromosome, you only have to unzip each one until it reaches the next bubble. So you're doing this simultaneously, and therefore the whole thing gets replicated a lot quicker. Does that make sense? Okay. Otherwise, the process is the same, though. At each replication bubble, you're separating the two strands. Therefore, you're able to read each strand as a code and lay down new material that is complementary to the template, original strand. And by the time you're done, just like in the case of a prokaryote, you have completely replicated the chromosome. You have two identical copies, one for each of the two cells that will eventually exist once this cell splits into two. All right. By the way, these are real photomicrographs, and you can see this is one replication bubble of this overall circular chromosome. And the two magenta arrows represent point out the replication forks. All right, now slide 10. This shows you at a molecular scale how this is done. Once again, dark blue represents the original DNA. Light blue is the new stuff that's being laid down according to the instructions in the original dark blue stuff. Okay, so this dark blue strand that's on the left of the screen is one of the two strands. The other strand's not being shown, but the same thing's happening for it. Okay, so this is one of the two original strands, and it has a certain sequence. These first three bases, our first three nucleotides, have already been laid down. So we're looking at this in the middle of the process. But now this is the next nucleotide being read from the template strand. You see that an A is here. That means it calls for a T, right? Well, the thing that needs to be in the final product is a subunit. What are those subunits called? Subunits out of which DNA is made. It's a nucleotide. Those are the subunits. Right? And remember, a nucleotide has a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and a phosphate. One phosphate. Well, the thing that comes in as raw material actually has a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and three phosphates. And I didn't tell you this before, but if you consider just the nitrogenous base and the sugar, just those two on their own, you would call that thing a nucleoside instead of a nucleotide. And therefore, if you have three phosphates connected to it instead of just one, it is a nucleoside triphosphate. All right? Now remember, you really only need one of these phosphates to be here for you to be able to link this thing to the growing chain and have it become part of the new DNA. So why do you have these extra two phosphates there? The answer is to provide the energy that's necessary for building this thing. When cells build large molecules out of smaller ones, that's part of metabolism that's called anabolism. Anabolism is the building up of larger molecules out of smaller ones. It's the opposite of catabolism, which is the other half of metabolism. Catabolism is the breaking down of large molecules into smaller ones. All right? Well, anabolism, the building up of bigger ones, is an expensive process. It doesn't happen on its own. You have to supply the energy necessary to do that. The energy, in this case, is chemical energy that's locked up as the chemical bonds holding these phosphates together. All right, there's chemical energy locked up in these phosphate-phosphate bonds. And if you break those bonds, you know, if you take just this last phosphate off, you break that bond, you release some energy. Or if you break this one, you release some energy. Some of the energy that you release can be put to work. In this case, you are going to cleave exactly this bond. You're going to take two of these phosphates off by cleaving this bond right here. What that leaves behind is a nucleotide, exactly what you need. Right? But by breaking that bond, bringing it in as a nucleoside triphosphate and breaking that bond, that releases energy which is required to sew this nucleotide to the growing strand. That's why you're able to build it up. So the phosphates, the extra phosphates, are an energy source. And you have, like I said, millions of these things already made in your cell, ready to go. You have millions of ones that have T, millions of ones that have C, that have A, and then have G. You just have a pool of all available nucleoside triphosphates. But each time you read a new one from the strand, that means only one of those four kind is allowed to come in. Right? So T is coming in next. The next one's going to be a G. And it just goes one at a time along the whole template strand. Now this orange box, which is labeled DNA polymerase, what kind of thing is that? What does the ASE ending on this word indicate? What? No. And I might not have told you this, so that in that case you won't know the answer probably. The ASE ending means that that is an enzyme. What is an enzyme? Well, certain cleaners do use enzymes, but they're not. That's not actually the definition of an enzyme. An enzyme is a biological catalyst. So an enzyme just is a catalyst that a cell makes. But what is a catalyst?
Reduces the energy required for a chemical reaction to take place.
Yes, that's exactly right. A catalyst is a substance that is able to speed up a reaction drastically, at least a million times faster, because it reduces the amount of energy that's required for that reaction. Okay? There are thousands of reactions that each of your individual cells are undergoing continuously throughout your lifetime. Thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions. And almost every one of those is sped up or catalyzed by its own enzyme. If you didn't have enzymes to speed up your reactions would not happen anytime soon, and therefore you wouldn't be able to live. So that's what many of your possible proteins that you make, a lot of those serve as enzymes. Enzymes are proteins acting as catalysts. Well, now back to this specific one. DNA polymerase is an enzyme that gets its name because its job is to polymerize DNA. In other words, to make a polymer of DNA out of monomers, the nucleotides. It builds it up one at a time and therefore makes a polynucleotide, which is a polymer. Okay, so this is the enzyme that allows this thing to be connected to this quickly. But in that process, like I said, these two phosphates are cleaved off to supply the energy. And that's why you see these two being spit off, basically. Two phosphates hooked to each other are called pyrophosphate, but it doesn't last as that very long. Those two then are cleaved apart into individual phosphates, and then they just get recycled. They're going to be stuck onto more building blocks basically, later on. But that's how the process occurs at a molecular level. Now, these final two slides are really one picture, but they just couldn't really fit it on one slide. But if you pan from left to right, you get to the next slide, and then it continues. As you do pan, though, you also are zooming out. So you are very, very close up here on the left side of this figure, I mean slide 11. All you're seeing here is the DNA as its double helical strands, right? Well, the DNA that's, if using a human as an example, the DNA that is in each of your cells, if you were to just stretch that out, have it just be, not stretch it, but just lay it out straight, then it would be over a meter long, longer than this stick. Because there's so many nucleotides. There's billions of nucleotides overall in each of your cells. Not only in each of your cells, in the tiny nucleus within each of your cells. Well, obviously that needs to be folded up in order to fit into a microscopic nucleus. And that's what this slide, these two slides are showing. DNA does not exist, doesn't stay stretched out. It is highly compacted so that the cell can fit it into itself. And DNA is not able to get very compact just on its own. It needs the help of proteins. So your chromosomes are made out of not just DNA. Your chromosomes are made out of a combination of DNA and protein. And that combination of DNA and protein is called chromatin. Chromatin is the stuff that chromosomes are made out of. The proteins are there to greatly aid in the compact storage of that DNA. It makes it a lot smaller and therefore able to fit into the nucleus. Now, there's different kinds of proteins, but most of those proteins are histones. Each histone here is represented as a purple sperm-looking thing. Right, a globular head with a tail. If you get 8 histones together in this arrangement, with the tails radiating out that way, then really what you have is like a little hose reel. Right? And therefore you can wind this long DNA molecule, part of it, around through this hose reel made up of the histone proteins. And when you do that, what you make, which is the 8 histones plus whatever DNA is wound around it, that is called a nucleosome. So that makes it a lot shorter, right? Just like reeling in your hose makes it shorter. Well, then you have a bunch of nucleosomes which then can be clumped together. And that's what you're seeing here. That makes it even more compact. When you continue to the right, which is actually on slide 12 now, and you can see that these clumps of nucleosomes can be looped back and forth. So notice you're zooming out as you go along to the right here. So all of these little loops contain thousands and thousands of nucleosomes, each of which is a little reel of DNA. And then these loops are themselves looped again to form the overall chromosome. This thing is a chromosome that actually consists of 2 identical halves, because this is in a cell that's just about to split. This is a replicated chromosome, not an ordinary chromosome. This is one that's already replicated. A replicated chromosome consists of 2 sister chromatids. Each chromatid is an exact copy of the other one. Because this one replicated chromosome is going to split into two, one for each of the two cells that will exist once the cell splits. Okay? So this is just one of your chromosomes. You have this happening for 45 other chromosomes as well. All of that is packed into a tiny nucleus in your cell before it splits. So it's a ridiculous amount of DNA that you have in there, actually. Somehow, it doesn't become a tangled mess. Because in order for you to use it for the other purpose, which is how to make proteins, you need to be able to get in there and read little sections of it, like taking out one book from a library. You know, each book would be like an instruction manual for how to build a protein. That's what genes are. Those genes are just segments of the length of DNA. But it all exists within this. And that's it. Now, I do need to give you your tests back, though, right? So I'll put the test up.